KGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Alistair Caruso, who is, among other things, a PhD student out of Concordia and the co-chair of Capital Pride in Ottawa. We discuss an article he recently published through LinkedIn and the Institute for Research on Public Policy called History Isn't Repeating Itself on LGBT Rights. And that is concerning. Now, how and why will be the bread and butter of our conversation a little later on.
EBD.
Now, before we get into that, I want to talk about Fruit Loops, but I think, we're going to start off with Fruit Loops, okay? That's what, first of all, first of all, the far superior breakfast cereal is Cinnamon Toast Crunch, hands down. I will hear nothing else. Cinnamon Toast Crunch, the best, wide margin.
I actually have an inroad to a meme because I am gluten intolerant. So my favorite one, there's these like sweetened corn puffs that taste like off-brand Captain Crunch, but they're famous because on the cover of the packaging, there's like this really calm looking gorilla, and that calm looking gorilla on the front of the gluten-free corn puff cereal is the basis for the Ruffle My Ghiblis theme. Meme. So there have been times, like when it first came out, I was like, yeah, I like that stuff. And then it does not ruffle my, and I was just like, yeah.
It doesn't ruffle your Ghiblis?
No. Yeah. It's breakfast cereal as a thing is, I don't know, when you're an adult, you think about it, you're like, you're feeding your child dessert for breakfast. I don't know if you ever.
Do you know what my favorite cereal was growing up?
What's that?
Above and beyond Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Muesli.
I know.
I was channeling my inner 80-year-old man from a very young age, and muesli with like random raisins and things was my jam. Now,
no, I'm into that. I would raid the baking goods cupboard. My brother would steal all the chocolate, and I would eat all the dried apricots. So, little 8-year-old apricots. Me stealing dried fruits. I mean, I'm there with you on the born an 80-year-old woman thing. Yeah. Anyway, we're talking about Fruit Loops.
So back in, I want to say like June or July, it was a while ago, Fruit Loops or Kellogg's, specifically the Canadian branch of Kellogg's, teamed up with Boys and Girls Canada and another organization whose name I'm forgetting. I think it's Kids Press, which is a branch. It's a publisher. It's a children's publisher. I think it's part of the Chorus Entertainment Group.
Okay.
And they released a bit of a collaboration just to promote books, stories for children to read that are free. And that's about the gist of it.
Okay.
You can get them on the front of books, of boxes, sorry. There is Maggie's Chopsticks, which is one of the books about a little girl who everyone keeps telling her how she's using her chopsticks wrong. And then in the end, spoiler alert, but her mum says, everyone uses them differently. It's fine. You know, there's no right way to use chopsticks.
So it depends where you are in the world, because in some places there is a right way and a wrong way, and people will stare at you if you use them incorrectly. But when I lived in China, they did have a thing there. And not only that, but the way that you held your chopsticks, it was kind of like reading the tea leaves, like where you held your chopsticks and how you they had like this like zodiac personality theory of, based on how you held your chopsticks. It was weird and fascinating. It was one of those things that everybody believes in, but nobody believes in. They're all like, it's nonsense, but let me tell you all about it.
Kind of want someone to read my chopsticks now. Like I want that to happen. So, and there's other ones, and they're all about kindness and community, you know, Going Up by Sherry J. Lee, elicited by Charlene Chua, is about an elevator. Everyone's been invited to a party on the 10th floor, and she goes up with her dad, and then, the elevator stops, and on gets the Sanchez brothers, sorry, the Santucci brothers, and then the Miguel family joins in, and then Mr. Kim joins in. And it's just about the diversity of people that you might bump into in an elevator where everyone is going to the same party. It's very exciting.
Okay.
There's other great books. I'm not going to go through all the books because honestly, that would just be too much. It's about riding a bicycle, a school that plants a tree, a village that plants a tree for every girl that's born. But they also have a collection by Fruit Loops and Big Boys and Girls Canada, BGC, where they curated some stories, some podcasts. We're going to be playing 30 seconds of Different Is Okay by Tiptoe Giants, as available on Spotify. Just to give you a quick sense here. Her
and she wins first place. Smile, say hi as she rolls by. Give it a try.
Plays drums in the band at school. They don't feel like a boy or a girl. We learn to say them and they, and that's okay. Different is different, and that's okay. We're all a little
the Liberty People, I forget what their name, I'll look it up now in a second. But they have decided that they're going to boycott Kellogg's and specifically Fruit Loops for promoting, you know, the trans inclusion. And honestly, the books were generic, you know. How do I use my chopsticks? Oh, I met somebody on an elevator. Very much about kindness, friendliness. You know, particular episodes from kid-focused podcasters that are out there. You know, it's these children's songs that everyone hates, but you have to play for some moral obligation, you know. And I think overall it was pleasant. Like the bulk of the stuff you get is pleasant. It's the kind of thing where if you have a kid that maybe lives in the city or lives going, you know, whatever, and they meet all kinds of people, you know, they might meet a young girl who races on a wheelchair and goes zoom, you know. Fruit Loops is all over the news for this boycott originating primarily out of the US for a Canadian promotion that barely mentions in passing trans folks.
These are little books that are attached?
Yeah, it's like ebooks. You can look at ebooks. Some of them are published like ebooks. Some of them are podcasts.
Wait, how are they little podcasts or ebooks? Bedtime stories. Box? Is it like a QR code?
Yeah, it takes you to a website.
Oh, okay. Well, So here's my solution to that. Don't let your kid access that if you have a problem with it. Like it's really not. I don't know. I have very little sympathy because it's as an adult, it's really easy, especially if the kid's like 6 years or under, to control the media that they consume. It's really not that hard. When my brother had his kids, he hated children's music, but he did manage to find an artist who, you know, you can like print out your own music box paper strips. So this guy basically made music box versions of Rob Zombie and Metallica. And that's what my brother would listen to with his kids because it was something they both liked. It sounded like a lullaby, but my brother knew in his heart that it was Dragula. So it's not that hard to find something that sort of cuts it both ways. And there are people from, I don't know, various religions, and they say, you know, this isn't very consistent with, you know, Judaism or Islam or Christianity or what have you. And they come across media for children. They're like, these are not the morals that I want to teach, or these are the morals that I want to teach, but I want them to look different. I want them to feel different. They're all alternative media. You don't have to boycott all of Fruit Loops because you want your kids to consume something else. Just have them consume something else. It's not that hard.
Well, What I will say to that is, I mentioned later in the interview, you know, we recently did our citizenship test. We've been kind of really diving in on what it means to be Canadian. Mm-hmm. And multiculturalism is foundational to Canada and being Canadian. Mm-hmm. It says so. They tell every immigrant that mm-hmm. it is foundational. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, and that you don't put that in the study book without it being thoroughly vetted and reviewed. Mm-hmm. Not a fan of the music, but I also don't have small children, which is sometimes a blessing. But that, I feel like it was Mums for Liberty, by the way, who have initiated the boycott.
I don't know, moving away from breakfast cereal. Just
yeah, moving away to breakfast, and let's jump all the way into nightlife. Okay. In London, the GAY, or Gay Late Bar, has finally closed its doors. Now, we've mm-hmm. talked about this iconic British gay bar that's been around for a bajillion years. Mm-hmm. And we talked about in the pandemic that a lot of places really struggled. And mm-hmm. you know what the nail in the coffin for this particular gay establishment?
What was that?
Construction.
Oh, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, they just genuinely can't keep going now that there's more construction for, I think it was like condos or something across the road. Mm-hmm. And they were like, look, you know, the way that queer folks gather and celebrate changes, less demand than there was before. Mm-hmm. And then there was the COVID pandemic that wiped out so many. They struggled through that. And mm-hmm. then there was some recovery. And now they're just being strangled by construction. And the guy's gone, you know what? And enough is enough.
I mean,
like,
there's
this
also,
it's sad, but it's...
There's intergenerational differences here on how people access club spaces. So obviously, if you're looking at the boomies, you're talking about discotheques. If you're talking about early Gen X, you're talking about the 80s dance clubs. If you're talking about late Gen X, you're talking about raves in the 90s. If you're talking about, you know, early millennials, you're still talking about the club scene, but... Then things kind of taper off because over time, the number of people who go out to nightclubs on the weekend has sort of dwindled. We don't have the dance culture we used to. We don't have the discotheque culture that we used to. And it's just different people have different interests and different things. The number of young people who drink when they go out has gone down. There's all sorts of numbers on that. There's numbers on people who stay in more, who... actually, there's also an epidemic of friendlessness among younger people. And I've gone out to clubs by myself, but that's because I just really like dancing and I knew a good club where I felt safe. So I would just go. But most people don't have that in them. Most people would never go to a club by themselves. So, I mean, it's just some of this is just club spaces are dying because clubbing is dying. The dance halls that sort of started as a thing in the 50s and 60s. And sort of peaked with the disco era, that culture of the West, well, at least in North America, is dying out. And it's shifting to festivals. So if you've ever seen a music video for something like Scooter, and you see these giant outdoor spaces with like 10,000 people, and they're doing this weird Dutch style of house dance called Gabba, and they're all... You know, they're all doing this out in the field, or they're doing, you know, the shuffle, or they're doing jump style, or they're doing all these weird like house style dances. That's the kind of thing that happens like twice a month. The kind of local bar that you can just be like, I don't know what to do. It's Saturday night. There's a local bar. Let's pop in and see what's happening. That culture is dying, and it's sort of moving towards a special event kind of culture. And people don't go to bars the way they used to. People will, like you and I, we've gone to pubs for a meal. But when was the last time you and I went out for a drink, just for a drink? Yeah, well, it all sparked off when there was a tourist from Surrey. Well, goes by the name of Bucky. The details beyond that are less important to the story. But this individual went to a bar that historically was a gay bar that transitioned to an anything goes bar and then recently transitioned to just a bar. I'm not going to say a straight bar because they don't advertise themselves as heterosexual establishment. They're just a bar who no longer targets the LGBT community. This tourist from Surrey went into the bar in Victoria and basically announced his presence as a gay man. And local patrons took umbrage to that because they felt that he was interrupting their good times and basically told them where to stick it. And one thing led to another. The staff of the bar didn't really step in to protect him too much. They basically said, just step outside and the problem will go away. And then eventually it all turned into a to-do. But it's not the kind of story that we would normally cover, because it's patron goes to bar, has negative experience, nobody got hurt. It's not,
it's shocking, not an exciting front story. Page cover. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But what it did do in Victoria is spark a conversation about the fact that there are no more gay bars there. And this is a growing story. We've been covering this basically since 2015. The sort of shrinking number of gay bars across Canada. And I would even argue across sort of, you know, the Anglosphere in general, gay bars have been sort of disappearing. And this is partly it is that intergenerational difference of people are just not going to bars the way they used to. Some of the people are just not going out the way they used to. And you're right, the pandemic and the lockdown really, really kicked that one while it was down, basically. And then there's also the issue of sort of general acceptance. A lot of people feel they don't have to go to a gay bar. They may prefer to go to a gay bar. And I could say, like, as I mentioned earlier, I used to go dancing all the time. On average, I would have a better time in a gay bar. But the best nights that I ever had were just in good clubs. They just advertised themselves as being a place for people who like dancing and liked good music to go and dance to good music. And they didn't target the gay clubs. They didn't target the gay community, but they did make it very clear that they would not tolerate harassment. So any kind of shoving or yelling, you're out. No, zero tolerance. If they do that to you one time too many and the bouncers recognize you, you're just not allowed back in. So it's sort of a generic, they're not really there for the gays, but they're not going to tolerate anyone being harassed. Those are the places where I had the best nights. And a lot of people are starting to transition to sort of like, well, let's just go to a good bar instead of a gay bar. And often the gay bars are the best bars, but sometimes they're not. It depends on, well, it depends on what kind of dancing you want to do. Like if you want to go to like a 80s retro night, gay bars don't really do that kind of thing that much anymore. So you're going to go outside the community for that. And there is this discussion about where social spaces are for the community now that bars are closing and they're not being reopened. A lot of people are starting to say, well, we need new gay bars. You know, if you have a city like Victoria where all the bars have closed, well, should we replace them? We need to replace them. Do we need to replace them? What would we replace them with if not?
I can see, I don't think this is unique to Victoria, BC. Mm. I think Montreal, New York, and
Montreal has no problem with gay bars.
But they have a club czar or a nighttime mayor or, you know, these people who are designed, and Ottawa has just launched a similar position because they must be desperate to kickstart some kind of nightlife. Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if I mentioned it to you, we were coming out of we went laser tagging. I think I told you when I forgot the word for the word squat. We went to laser tag and we were like, oh, we should go out and do a 90s night somewhere, you know, just, you know, have a good time, dance with music. And I was like, oh, maybe this place, or maybe that place, or maybe this other place. Every one of them was closed.
Well, there is an issue as well in Canada with NIMBYism, and this is sort of related, very distantly, but not completely unrelated to the housing crisis, where NIMBYism is coming in. So everybody knows that a good nightlife attracts young people. It attracts money. It attracts tourism. You know, a good nightlife in a city is good for a city on many fronts, but where do you put it? Nobody wants to hear the noise. And this is something that I've always found baffling, that people don't know what to do with it, because, not to drive it home again too much, but yeah, when I lived in Hong Kong, they had rules there about where you could put nightclubs. And do you know where they put them?
I think it was the financial district, isn't it?
The financial district and industrial zones, because no one is there at night. So in the case of Toronto, you'd put it on Bay Street. You know, in the case of Ottawa, actually, we used to have one on Spark Street. There was a gay bar on Spark Street, and it was loud. And the closest house was like a 5-minute walk away, but there's all these tall buildings in the way. You couldn't hear it. Some of the best nightclubs that I've gone to were in old warehouses that were next to functioning warehouses. It was just, you know, it's there at night. And the greatest thing about the financial district is you have all this infrastructure there already. So you have people going out drinking. You don't want them to drive home drunk, but it's the financial district. You have all your streetcars and subways and buses. Everything's already there. You have the infrastructure that you need to get people from there to home already. Mm-hmm. And no one's there at night. You can be as loud as you want.
But I think there is a conversation to be had about respect. And mm-hmm. we have had that conversation multiple times mm-hmm. about straight folks entering queer spaces. And I'm wondering if we put much thought into queer folks entering straight spaces. All right. That's all we've got time for.
Non-queer spaces.
Non-queer spaces.
I mean, yeah. A maternity ward, I would say. And even then, like, there's not many places that I would call heterosexual spaces.
I mean, you're pretty solid there, the maternity ward. Like, there is, you know, like, it would be exceptional. All right, this is Jane Birkin, a new track by Mika. And after that, we have the conversation with Francesco McAllister Caruso. And we will be back briefly at the end of the show to wrap up some other news. Caruso, who is a PhD student studying trans folks in Canada, as well as, I mean, honestly, I'm amazed that you're clocking more Via Rail mileage than I can dream of, commuting between Montreal and Ottawa, as you are both at Concordia and the co-chair of Capital Pride in the city of Ottawa. Mouthful of an introduction, but I am thrilled to have you join us.
Thank you for having me, Luke. I'm happy to be here as well.
Excellent. Now, when I first saw this article, and it was, I saw it through LinkedIn, and it's history isn't repeating itself on LGBTQ rights. That is concerning. You published it through the Institute for Research on Public Policy, like I said, on LinkedIn. I feel like that is concerning is. It's not the biggest understatement that I've read in a while, but it certainly stood out. So just for our listeners who haven't read the piece, you know, why isn't history repeating itself on LGBTQ rights?
So there's often this misconception among queer and trans people today that because conservative parties and conservative politicians have been so antagonistic towards our rights, especially in recent years, that this is how things have always been. There's a bit like this impression that the progress on LGBTQ rights has been linear, it's been straightforward, and so we assume that things were worse before and they've gotten better. And certainly that's true for a number of our rights that we've gained over the past few decades, but really conservative politicians' attitudes towards LGBTQ rights have changed drastically over the past four decades. So in my article, the example that I talk about, or the element that I talk about specifically, is the use of the notwithstanding clause and how conservative politicians, especially in the 80s and 90s, when there were a lot of court cases that were coming out in favor of queer and trans people, conservative politicians really resisted calls to use the notwithstanding clause to go back to the status quo and prevent queer and trans people from having their rights implemented. So even if we have the impression that conservatives today are very antagonistic towards our rights, that doesn't mean that it always was the case. Even if they certainly weren't always friends, they were not necessarily the hyper evil villain that we sometimes imagine in hindsight.
I think that's a really interesting sort of delve into history. We kind of have this rose-tinted view of, you know, things were dreadful before and it's never going to be quite that bad. I do wonder if that perspective is more indicative of gay men, cis gay men in particular, cis white gay men in particular, says the cis white gay man. But you know, I do wonder if that's part of it. Is like, oh, well, you know, well, I'm fine. I'm okay. You know, I can have kids. I can be gay at work. I can get married. I can file taxes and have access to the same benefits as others. I can access my partner's pension. I don't know if you can, but it seems like a thing you could do. You know, like all of these rights exist. Okay, it's fine. Like, I am fine. And screw the rest of you. You know, is there a sense of, you know, queer progress stopped once gay men felt like, okay, our job's done. I'm going to brush my hands of this and walk away.
Absolutely. I would say there's definitely, so in the kind of political science policy literature, the big debate, and we also find this in community, the big debate that we discuss is that between assimilationists and liberationists. So the assimilationist camp is much more along the lines of how you described it, Luke. So let's, you know, emulate the straight cis heteropatriarchy as much as possible, which is to say, let's get married, let's have a pension, let's have 2.5 children in the white picket fence. And the more that we can assimilate into that mainstream straight cis world, the more successful we'll be as citizens. And, you know, I think that the reason why that perspective was so popular is because it had been largely successful, again, for the white cis gay men, usually, in the 90s and the 2000s with the advent of same-sex marriage. The other camp, the liberationist camp, which is more in line with, you know, trans rights, sex worker rights, bringing in racialized and BIPOC folks to the forefront of the movement because they've always been the ones leading this work. That camp has been more or less neglected by the mainstream LGBTQ rights movement. And now today, we're kind of seeing a bit of a reversal in the sense that we've gotten same-sex marriage, we've gotten all of those economic benefits if you're in a couple, we've gotten our anti-discrimination legislation. And yet, despite all of this, despite the anti-discrimination approach being very well entrenched in the Canadian legal system, we're still today seeing conservative politicians who want to dismantle that. So I think it has been a bit of a wake-up call to folks who are maybe more in the assimilationist camp, for whom things had been going very well up until now. We're now seeing, oh, wait a second, if we don't actually stay vigilant, if we don't actually keep actively defending our rights instead of just passively assuming they're going to continue into the future, we may be in for a rough ride, and it may